What practical impacts could a non-binding referendum on Kurdistan independence from Iraq have on the stability of the Middle East region? What would an independent Kurdistan mean for Kurds across the region? How will non-Kurdish ethnic groups in places like Kirkuk fare if an independent Kurdistan became a reality? Why would Turkey threaten to stop oil exports out of the Kurdish region if they gain economically from those exports? What kind of hardships are the people of the region facing, and would they be resolved if Kurdistan were to separate? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we take a look at the recent independence vote in Iraqi Kurdistan and the overwhelming endorsement of separation from the rest of Iraq, and what it means for Iraq, the larger region, and the world, and whether it is the Kurdish people or larger imperial powers that benefit from the overall situation. We'll get a historical perspective from Professor Henry Heller. We'll get the view from a Canadian of Kurdish extraction. And we'll hear from journalist Joe Loria, who was in the capital city of the Kurdistan region during the referendum vote. He'll offer his thoughts about activities on the ground and the motivations of the larger powers. On this week's program, Deconstructing the Kurdistan Referendum: The Winners, the Losers, and the Fate of a Region. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 29th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory and the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Netanyahu ordered the Interior Ministry, quote, to evaluate revoking the citizenship of those who call for the destruction of the State of Israel, unquote. In 2011, legislation authorized Israel's Supreme Court to revoke the citizenship of Israelis convicted of terrorism or espionage, the measure directed at Arabs, not Jews. In March 2016, Netanyahu sought Attorney General Mandelblit's authorization to deport families of Palestinian activists for justice to Gaza, falsely calling them terrorists. At the time, Israeli Intelligence and Atomic Energy Minister Yisrael Katz urged their deportation to Syria. Mandelblit wanted none of it, during a security cabinet meeting, saying proposed deportations violate international and Israeli law. That comes from the article Deporting Palestinians by Stephen Lendman, posted September 27th. Syria's government is the creation and perpetuation of localized special interests, backed by various alliances ranging from the former Soviet Union in the past to Russia, Iran, and to a lesser degree China in present day. The United States and its Arab partners, particularly Saudi Arabia, have engineered militancy along and within Syria's borders, beginning in 2011 for the explicit purpose of overthrowing Syria's government and dividing what remains of the nation among proxies and client regimes controlled from Washington, London, and Brussels. In Myanmar, while the U.S. and its Saudi partners are apparently fueling militancy among the Rohingya population, it was the U.S. itself who for decades built up the political networks of the current ruling regime, with Aung San Suu Kyi, a whole cloth creation of Western media narratives, immense funding and political support, and a carefully crafted facade to obfuscate from the public for decades the true nationalist and even genocidal nature of Suu Kyi's supposedly Buddhist nationalist support base. An extensive 2006 report by Burma Campaign UK titled Failing the People of Burma, PDF, would reveal how virtually every facet of Myanmar's current government is a creation of Western political and financial support. That comes from the article Analysis by Analogy: Myanmar is Not Syria, by Tony Cartolucci, posted September 27th. There is enormous pressure and a lot of money working to rehabilitate Vietnam to put the guilt and the shame of it behind us. But it was precisely the guilt of the people, their shame at what was being done in their name, and their courage to denounce it that made it impossible for their government to carry out the savagery any longer. Would that we had that kind of guilt, shame, and courage among us today. Remember, if we had to lie about it, it was wrong. That is as true today as it was then, is it not? That comes from the article, There is No Rehabilitating the Vietnam War, by Robert Freeman, posted September 27th, originally appearing at Common Dreams. At the beginning of Ken Burns' new documentary on the American War in Vietnam, the narrator says the war, quote, was begun in good faith by decent people out of fateful misunderstandings, American overconfidence, and Cold War misunderstandings, unquote. The early American involvement in Vietnam can be marked by two things in particular. One, helping the French imperialists in their fight against the forces led by Ho Chi Minh of North Vietnam. And two, the cancellation of the elections that would have united North and South Vietnam as one nation because the U.S. and its South Vietnam allies knew that Ho Chi Minh would win. It was that simple. Nothing of good faith or decency in that scenario. No misunderstandings. That comes from the article, Cold War Then, Cold War Now, by William Bloom, posted September 27th, originally appearing at williambloom.org. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The autonomous region in northern Iraq, known as the Kurdistan region or Iraqi Kurdistan, held an independence election on Monday, September 25th. The result was overwhelmingly in favor of splitting from the rest of Iraq. The population in the capital Erbil was reportedly jubilant. However, the Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi deemed the referendum to be unconstitutional, and the Iraqi parliament has called for the deployment of troops to the nearby city of Kirkuk to take control of the oil fields there. The Turkish government is threatening to cut the tap on the oil pipeline on which the oil exports out of the country depend. The Kurds have had long-standing grievances with governments in both countries. To put this week's referendum in some kind of historical context, we're joined by Henry Heller. He is a professor of history at the University of Manitoba. He's also the author of several books, including The Bourgeois Revolution in France, 1789 to 1815, and The Capitalist University, The Transformation of Higher Education in the United States, 1945-2016. Thank you, Professor Heller, for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad you called me and I can participate in this interview.
Who are the Kurds, and what distinguishes them from other ethnic groups in the region?
I believe the Kurds go back quite a long way, and I think they, as my memory recalls, they may be connected with, historically with the Medes, who were an ethnic group which Saul already mentioned in antiquity. So they're a very old people. They're mainly Islamic. I think that there are some of them practice other religions, but I think they're mainly Islamic. They have a distinctive language. And I think what is notable about them in the modern period is that whereas the aspirations of the Arabs, at least formally, were recognized, in the 20th century, and essentially Arab states were able to establish themselves in the wake of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the Kurds, who in terms of geography are to be found in what is now Turkey, Iraq, and Iran, were never able to satisfy their national aspirations, their state. And they've had, since the middle of the 20th century, this ongoing struggle to try to somehow carve out some sort of national state from these two states, these three states, the Turkey, Iran, and Iraq. And they were frustrated in their attempts, or suppressed, by these three governments, Iran, Iraq, and Turkey, for many years. The American invasion of Iraq changed the situation because, in effect, the central government in Iraq lost control of northern Iraq. With American support, the Kurds were able to basically create an autonomous zone. And what they've done now with this referendum is basically they've declared by a large majority that they wish to be independent, which has implications for Iraq, but also for Syria and Turkey as well, and Iran as well, all of the states of the region. An independent Kurdish state would have serious implications.
Mm. Well, I mean, there are these, there are Kurdish populations in Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. I mean, to what extent are these populations interchangeable? I mean, they all identify with as Kurds, but you know, could you are there any critical differences?
Yes, I understand. Well, the Kurdish population is socially differentiated. There are more or less wealthy Kurds. There are middle class Kurds. There are some workers, and there are peasant farmers, and these groups have different interests, and the largest party amongst them was a party which, for many years, the PKK, I think it's called, was explicitly Marxist, and not everybody who was a Kurd agreed with the left-wing politics of this party. I think more recently it may be that this party has sort of inflected its politics, and one sees a kind of a movement towards a kind of more communitarian anarchist tendency amongst the more radical Kurds. That's what I would say.
Hmm. Now, in terms of what's going to result, there was a statement from an Iraqi official, and he basically accused quote-unquote racist Kurds of trying to establish a second Israel that will throw the region into years of conflict. I don't know, I'm seeing some parallels there between, like, you know, Zionist Jews seeking their own homeland and the these Kurds forming their own country. I'm wondering, are the similarities and the critical differences between those two? I mean, a second Israel and everything that implies in the public imagination would seem to be a reason for concern. But what are your thoughts about that comparison?
I would say, on the one hand, the Kurds have been in the region for thousands of years, and I think that, and it's problematic because the establishment of a national entity, a state for the Kurds, would be against the national interests of the Iranians the Iraqis, the Syrians, and the Turks. And so it's a threat. But I would say that the difference is the difference between these Kurds and Israel, that Israel is a relative, is an intruder into the area. And I don't think you could say that about the Kurds. But the reference that is made is also related to the fact that it seems evident that the Israelis are behind the scenes supporting the Kurds, and they're doing that in order to basically weaken all of these Arab states. And so there is this Israeli-Kurd connection. I think that also is in play in this situation.
So as a historian, I mean, given the kinds of dynamics that seem to be materializing, what is your take on the meaning of this overwhelming vote in favor of independence? Is a civil war imminent, perhaps, or some kind of conflict with the neighboring states?
I guess I would say that this the region, of course, is very unstable, and this makes it worse, because in the first place, I mean, Iraq, which is a de facto a divided country between the Sunnis in the south, the Shiites in the middle, and the Kurds in the north. Now the Kurds are basically saying with this vote that they wish to be completely independent of the rest of Iraq. It's a virtual vote of secession. So it is a final and grievous blow to the idea of Iraq as an integral state. They say, a state with real sovereignty. And that means that Iraq is permanently truncated and weak. But also, and this is, I think, a very important aspect of this, an independent Kurdish state in the north of Iraq becomes a pole of attraction for Kurds living in Syria, Iran, and Turkey, and the aspiration being to for all of the Kurds in all of these states to unite together. And if, in fact, this Kurdish state were to come into existence in northern Iraq, that would be the focal point for the carving out of Kurdish territories and their amalgamation with this Kurdish state. For example, in Syria, as a result of the civil war, the Kurds already have virtual autonomy within Syria. And one could see them easily linking up with such a state. And so on in Iran and in Turkey. So all of these states, their very existence would be threatened by a Kurdish state.
Well, it's very, very fascinating development. It seems to be getting underplayed in the media, in my view. But I want to thank you very much for sharing these insights with us.
Sure. I'm glad to talk to you about them. I hope I've been able to throw some light on what's going on there. And I would say that it's important for the listening public to look behind the flashing headlines and to try and sort of understand to look for stories in the media and online, and they're usually online, which delve more deeply into the background to some of the things that are happening. And I think it's very important in particular to be aware of the machinations of the great powers, and especially of the United States and Israel, when it comes to this Middle Eastern politics.
Well, we'll certainly have to see how these events evolve over the coming weeks and months. Thank you for your time.
Okay.
We've been speaking with Henry Heller, professor of history at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. To provide a Kurdish perspective on Monday's referendum and its aftermath, we reached Namatullah Emri. He is a Canadian citizen of Kurdish extraction living in Winnipeg. He's the vice president of the Kurdish Association of Manitoba. Mr. Emri, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having this interview with me.
Now, please tell us, how did you and fellow Kurds living in Winnipeg, in the Winnipeg community, receive the news of the vote when it came in?
Well, this is a dream of Kurds for 100 years, or since World War First. This is a dream of to have an independent country, to have an independent voice, and this is a right given to every nation, everybody in the world, that taken away from the Kurdish people. So this is like a dream to come true.
What are friends and relatives and contacts in the region telling you about what's been happening there since voting day?
Well, everything is so far looks good there, but expected, like we see a lot of things going on the news. There is a lot of relation between Turkish, Kurdistan, from Kurds from Turkish side and the Kurds from Iraqi side, a lot of economical relation, a lot of businesses. Like for example, in Erbil, there are 1,300 companies established by the people from Turkey. So of course, there's a lot of fear there. Something is going to, if they close everything, what's going to happen? But we know that these are all games. Turkey and Iran and Iraq, they are playing some scary games, try to scare some the Kurdish people there. They've been doing these games for years and years and years. If you see like a country like Turkey, Iran, and Iraq, really they have never been close to each other when it comes to the general discussions or the view of the world or anything. They all have their own agenda and basically run their country in a different path. But when the question is the Kurdish people, they all get together. They all get together like they've done in history like many, many, many times to have to attack or have to diminish the Kurdish movement.
As you know, the Iraqi government has been saying they won't respect the vote, let alone negotiate terms. They're shutting down flights to and from Erbil as of today, Friday the 29th. Additionally, Turkey is threatening to shut the tap on oil exports out of Iraqi Kurdistan. Is there any concern that the situation could get worse for Kurds in the region?
Well we are concerned. Of course we are concerned. This is not only going to hurt the Kurdistan part of Iraq, it's also going to hurt the Turkey as well. As you know, Kurdistan regional government is the second largest country for Turkey dealing with economic-wise. Basically, they're one of the biggest trade partners for Turkey. So all these goods and services from Turkey also go to Kurdistan region. It's going to affect the Turkish economy. As you know, Turkey doesn't have that many friends around it. So this is going to affect them and also going to affect the people who are living in Kurdistan. At the end, both sides, the Kurds are going to be paying the bill.
Now, there have been some fears that have been raised about how the non-Kurd minorities, Turkmen and Arabs, would be treated in an independent Kurdish state, particularly Kirkuk, which is in disputed territory. Do you feel such concerns are legitimate?
Not really.
No?
To be honest with you, this is the worst thing we can worry about. Because as a Kurd, for the years and years and years, as of now, as you see, we are fighting for freedom for every nation in Middle East, not only for for our nation. If we have that agenda, we would have a free Kurdistan long, long time ago. Our mainline stream is the Kurdistan regional government also wants that, have a free country for all the nations living in the area. It's not only going to be for the Kurdish people. We have a very good example of it in Rojava, when in Syria, the Kurdish people are including all other nations in their meeting, in their community, is also the co-leadership for all these areas. So we are a nation are fighting for our freedom. When we're fighting our freedom, we are not going to diminish for the nation's freedom who are living with us. We're going to help them. We're going to support them. That should be our mandate.
As I understand it, a lot of oil has been sold out of the Kurdistan region, you know, largely in defiance of the central government. And you've got, you know, a lot of the proceeds coming out of that. And then, you know, if Turkey does, in fact, you know, shut down that tap, as they are threatening, that could cause a lot of economic hardship, no?
Well, I'm not that much familiar with internal part of KRG, Kurdistan Regional Government, dealing with the other countries. But as I know, Iraqi government had an agreement with the Kurdistan Regional Government how to share the income of the area or the country. They were supposed to pay 17% of income to the Kurdistan Regional Government for support the people living there. As we know, they never, as we know, they did not hold their bargaining part, and then they didn't, even for months and months and years, this money didn't come from the Iraqi government to the area. So there was they didn't have any other choice to sell the oil to support the area themselves. And as we know, there are almost 2 million refugees right now living in Kurdistan regional Kurdistan regional government area with no help from anybody else. The second thing is shutting down the oil pipe. It's not that easy. Turkey has an agreement with this government. Lots of other countries have an agreement with the Kurdistan regional government. I don't know. It's just that easy to shut up the pipe there. There must be some other alternative. Somebody has to pay for consequences.
Okay, Mr. Emery, we really appreciate your time, and we look forward to following this story as it develops. So thank you.
I appreciate for you to reaching us. And also I want to know that there isn't any other nation than Kurds paying price for democracy, for freedom, not only for themselves, for the region. We are at the front line. We pay price with our blood, with our brave Peshmerga and guerrillas. They are fighting for freedom of not only for Kurds, for all everybody in the world, and especially in the Middle East. So I think world owe us an apology, and it is time for that. It is time to support the Kurdish movement. It is the time for support the Kurdish independence. Can you please tell me, is there anybody in the world that the nation wants to get to be independent, better freedom, live in peace and prosperity, and somebody else say that, no, that's not good? Well, if it's peace and prosperity and freedom is good for one nation, it should be for everybody in this world.
Mr. Emery, thank you for your time.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Namtula Emery. He is a Canadian of Kurdish extraction. He's the vice president of the Kurdish Association of Manitoba, and we spoke to him here in Winnipeg.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
What are the larger regional ramifications of Monday's referendum vote? Preliminary indications suggest increased tensions, particularly with Turkey and the Iraqi government. But how exactly will events unfold, especially for the ethnically mixed Iraqi city of Kirkuk, which was included in the referendum vote? Joe Loria is a veteran foreign affairs journalist. He's written for the Boston Globe, the Sunday Times of London, and the Wall Street Journal, among other newspapers. He spent a lot of time in Erbil and was there for the referendum vote. He wrote an article on the eve of the vote and published it at Consortium News. It's called "Vote by Iraqi Kurds Adds to Tensions." He joins us from Cairo. Joe Loria, we've seen intense reactions to the referendum result, both from Kurds and from regional governments. How appropriate is that, given that this was supposedly a non-binding referendum?
I think it's totally inappropriate, an overreaction, and a dangerous one. This referendum, as you say, was purely the expression of the will of the Kurdish people of northern Iraq for independence. It has not been followed and will not be followed by a declaration of independence. And there's only one country in the world, Israel, that has supported this referendum and has said publicly they would support and recognize an independent Kurdistan. So this referendum will die of its own accord if nothing happens. Why? Because Masoud Barzani, the leader, long-term leader of the Kurds in Iraq, has said repeatedly that there won't be a declaration of independence, but what he sees from this referendum is a mandate for him to negotiate with Baghdad the independence over 1 to 2 years. But Baghdad will not enter into negotiations over independence. So there won't be any talks, there's no recognition, and if Turkey and Baghdad did nothing, this would just end as an expression of the political will of the Kurdish people and the semi-autonomy that they have enjoyed since 1991 and even more so since 2003, American invasion. Will just continue the way it is. In other words, the status quo will continue if Turkey and Baghdad do nothing. But they are not doing nothing. They are acting in a nationalistic and chauvinistic and aggressive way, claiming that this is a threat to their security. The neighboring countries of Iran and Syria are also opposed because they feel it's going to stir up their rest of the Kurdish populations. But they've had trouble with that for decades in Turkey. The Kurds there have been fighting for 30 years against the Turkish state for independence and have not succeeded. They don't need this referendum in Iraq to spur them on, because they've been spurred on for 3 decades. In Iran, there was a celebration on Tuesday and was reported of Kurds in northern Iran, and it was reported that the Iranians are arresting leaders because they displayed the Kurdish flag and sang Kurdish national anthem, which are both illegal in Iran. And Syria is far more complex. We can talk about that more later. But basically, Syrian Kurds are fighting with the central government in Damascus against ISIS and al-Qaeda. So the government has tolerated their calls for autonomy. They don't want independence. They want something like what exists now in Iraq, an autonomous government. They had elections last weekend, Syrian Kurds, for local councils, and they are having an election in January to create their first parliament. But that will be all sorted out once that war in Syria ends.
Now, I mentioned that you happened to be in Iraq, in Erbil, the day of the referendum. Could you just talk a little bit about what you observed and maybe some of what you experienced getting out?
Yes, I was in Erbil and for a rally on a Friday before the referendum on Monday, which at a football stadium there where Barzani spoke. There was an enormous amount of celebration going on. The fireworks began a week before, literal fireworks. People driving their cars down the middle of the thoroughfares, flying the Kurdish flag, blaring their horns. It was as if they'd won the World Cup. And as if they were going to become a sovereign state the day after the referendum, which of course is not true, as I explained. So the day of the referendum itself was extremely calm. People voted. There wasn't a lot of celebration that day, but the next day it started up again, of course. And I feared that they would block flights coming out of Iraqi Kurdistan. I thought at the time that the reaction would be not military, not a military intervention, although that's being threatened, but an economic blockade and closing down of all the borders. So I flew out on Wednesday morning here to Cairo, and later that day on Wednesday, the Baghdad government gave the Kurds 3 days to turn over the airport and all the borders to the central government. Now, the Kurds have refused to do that. So a little bit later today, on Friday, this flight ban will go into effect, and most international carriers have already stated that they will cease flying into and out of Erbil and Sulaymaniyah, which is the other airport in Iraqi Kurdistan. So I was able to get out in time. Otherwise, I may have been stuck in a country where, if there is an economic blockade, life would become extremely difficult.
Well, it's interesting. I was talking to a gentleman locally from the Kurdish diaspora, and he was he didn't seem that concerned about that aspect of it. I mean, he mentioned that that like in terms of the this blockade, I mean, that there's a level of the Kurdish, excuse me, there's already agreements between the KRG area and you know, and other countries, so shutting down these pipelines would not be so easy. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, Turkey stands to lose a lot if there's an economic blockade. First, these oil sales, which Baghdad says are illegal because they should go through the central government, have been being sold at a discount to Turkey. There's talk amongst Turks that I know that Erdogan is personally profiting from it, and so is Barzani. So there would be also a great loss, billions of dollars a year in trade between Turkey and the Iraqi Kurdish area. They import most of their food from Turkey and Iran, 70% from Turkey and about 30% from Iran. The Iraqi Kurds are not self-sufficient in food, although they have very fertile soil. They preferred to import this food. They claim that they have the Kurds' 6 months of wheat supplies. Turkey would be hurt by this blockade as well. So that might give them pause. Baghdad is not trading very much with the Kurdish regions, so they would be less affected by an economic blockade. But this is what's been threatened. Erdogan said yesterday that he would only buy oil from the central government now, and the Baghdad government has said they're going to shut down all the borders and the airport this afternoon at 5 p.m. local time, or 6 p.m. local time. So we shall see how long that blockade would last. Your friend that you spoke to, the Kurd you spoke locally, might be right in saying because of the impact it would have on Iran as well, on Turkey especially, on Russia, which has a huge, the largest foreign investment in the oil sector in the Kurdish region, that this blockade might not last very long. And it's unnecessary, as I said at the beginning, because this referendum is not going anywhere if there are not going to be any talks towards independence, which Barzani wants over the next 2 years. So it could just come and go, and nothing will change. The status will remain the same, and there's no reason for this overreaction from Baghdad and Ankara. But that's what we've had, and maybe they'll come to their senses and realize that they're hurting themselves and this is unnecessary.
Now, it seems to me, just continuing with Turkey, I mean, it's not just the government, but Turkish businesses are very, like, literally invested and all over the Kurdish region, this Kurdistan region. So, I mean, I can understand on the other hand, there are concerns about, you know, some sort of a Kurdish being inspired in the southeast of their country. So, I mean, I'm wondering, is there some kind of a third way for them to explore where they don't have to worry so much about, you know, the Kurdish drive for independence at the same time protect those business interests?
Yes, they could just do nothing. And as I said, the referendum in the Iraqi Kurdish region will amount to nothing if nothing is done. And nothing will be done because there won't be talks with Baghdad over independence. So there are billions of dollars, as I said, in trade from Turkey to the Iraqi Kurds, and that will be lost if this embargo is in place and continues for long. So I think Turkish business interests would pressure the government not to continue with this embargo. They've been fighting 30 years, these Kurds. In Turkey, I don't think this referendum makes a whole lot of difference one way or the other about that war that continues and will continue for the foreseeable future inside Turkey. So there's no reason for Turkey to act at all. But, you know, this is Erdogan. He's quite an authoritarian leader and a bombastic leader. And he has to say something. He has to do something. He has, you know, interest, too, in northern Iraq. He's never accepted, as many Turks have not had, the settlement after the First World War, because the first Treaty of Sèvres gave they never accepted the Ottoman, defeated Ottomans, that this Veliaht of Mosul, which includes the Kurdish areas, would belong to Baghdad. And they never accepted that. They still have some kind of claim over northern Iraq. But, you know, if Turkey and Iraq jointly invade from the north and they're holding maneuvers about a kilometer north of the Iraqi border, which I think is highly unlikely, I don't think the Iraqi government would want Turks to stay there and claim the territory. It would be to put down this Kurdish referendum, which is not a declaration of independence. So I don't see an invasion. I do not see a long-term blockade either. I think Turkey will come to their senses and realize that their own interests are being hurt by trying to punish the Kurds when this referendum really isn't as great a threat to their national security as they say that it is.
You mentioned earlier that Israel is the only vocal supporter of an independent Kurdistan. Do you read more into that than just affection for the Kurdish people and their freedom-fighting ways?
Oh, yeah, certainly I do. I think the interests of Israel have been borne out over the decades. They've had a close relationship with Iraqi Kurds since the 1960s. In the 1970s, they, with the Shahs of Iran and the United States, armed Kurdish rebels, the Peshmerga, against the central government in Baghdad. That was unceremoniously ended overnight when Iran, under the Shah and the Iraqi government, with Vice President Saddam Hussein, they made an agreement in Algiers to settle the differences that they had. And one of the conditions that Iraq demanded was that Iran stop supporting the Kurds in the north. And they did, overnight, cut them off. Israel did the same. Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State at the time, apparently reportedly made a rude remark about the Kurds and cut them off. So the Israelis, you know, used them against the government of Baghdad, which they had seen as a threat and continue to see as a threat. So Israel's interests in an Iraqi Kurdistan, in an independent Iraqi Kurdistan, are twofold. One, to break up states in the region, Arab states that they consider to be their enemies. This has been a long-standing defensive position of the Israeli government. So by cutting off Kurdistan from the north, this weakens and divides Iraq. They would certainly like to see that happen, because the other reason is the Israelis would be able to legally operate from Kurdish territory out of an embassy, and they could penetrate the Iranian border and stir up the Iranian Kurds there and supply them, if they would try anyway, because they would like to see break up Iran as well. We know that the U.S. and Israel have been involved in Baluchistan and the south of Iran. So breaking up Iran, which is considered the number one enemy of the Israelis now, is certainly an objective of theirs. And under Saddam, that was the largest enemy of Israel, and the American invasion took care of that by weakening Iraq, although it gave power to Shia in the south, and the Shia central government, with enormous Iranian influence there. So this is Israel's interest. Now, there's also been talk here, I've heard from a source who's close to Barzani, that both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have privately told the Kurdish officials in northern Iraq that they also support the referendum, but they've made no public statement in that regard. And I think maybe the Americans, who were against the referendum as well, saw to that they would not make a public statement. Well, they, also, the Arab League was against this referendum, and Saudis and the Emiratis are part of the Arab League as well, so they wouldn't want to oppose that. But I don't know if that's true, but that's possible, because the Emiratis and the Saudis have the same interests as the Israelis do in their opposition to Iran and to the Baghdad government, they would like, which is Shia run, so they would like also to weaken Iraq and have a way to get into Iran.
Now, You wrote an article just the day before the referendum, or it was published a day before the referendum, and it's called Vote by Iraqi Kurds Adds to Tensions. And in that article, you did speak quite at some length about the city of Kirkuk, which is a very ethnically mixed city whose demographics has shifted over the course of the 20th century. What kinds of dynamics are playing out there with regards to this non-binding vote? Is there anything there that you'd like to elaborate on as a major focus of concern?
It is a major focus of concern. It's the place where violence, if there is going to be violence, is most likely to break out. The city of Kirkuk was, in the early 20th century, largely a Turkmen city, because the Ottomans, who still controlled it, moved a lot of Turkish speakers into that city. When oil was discovered, and it's the richest oil area of northern Iraq, in the 1920s, Kurdish and Arab workers were moved in there, so the demographics shifted. But we have there's not been a census since 1957, so we don't really know what the demographics of the city is. What happened in 2014, when ISIS came on the scene and took over Mosul, when the Iraqi army fled, they took Mosul. The same thing happened in Kirkuk. The Iraqi army fled. The Kurds don't look like playing Kirkuk and Turkmen and the Arabs. They took control of the city.
Sorry, Joe, I think you're going to have to repeat that a little bit. You just kind of went fuzzy there for a second.
All right. The city of Kirkuk has a complex history. In the early 20th century, the Ottoman Empire brought in a lot of Turkish speakers. It was a largely Turkmen city, but in the 1920s, a lot of Arab and Kurdish workers, when oil was discovered, that's the richest oil area in northern Iraq, we haven't had a census since 1957, so we don't really know what the demographics of that city is. But what happened in 2014, when ISIS took Mosul, the Iraqi army fled, and they then threatened Kirkuk, which is claimed by Kurds, the Turkmen, and the Arabs. One reason the Kurds claim it is because in the 70s, I should add, Saddam Hussein's government had a program of Arabization. They moved out forcibly Kurdish families and put Arab families there to try to change the demographics. And after the American invasion in 2003, a lot of Arabs fled and Kurds moved back in who had been expelled. So, but again, we don't have a census since 1957, so we don't really know who's in control. But in 2014, the Peshmerga blocked the ISIS from taking Kirkuk, and they have provided security and controlled the city ever since. In the last 3 years, the governor of the Kirkuk government or province is a Kurd. He was fired by the Iraqi parliament right after the referendum, and he's refused to step down. So Shia militia has stated publicly that if Kirkuk became part of a independent Kurdistan, that they would fight, they would go there and fight. But most alarmingly, the parliament in a 12-point the list of demands that they made the other day on the Kurdish government in Erbil has stated that they will send Iraqi National Army troops to Kirkuk to take the city from the Peshmerga. That's really where violence could occur, because the Kurds would fight and there would be bloodshed. That hasn't happened yet, and hopefully it won't.
Now, why do we talk about that kind of big elephant in the in the room, the United States. Now, vocally, they've been speaking a lot about having concerns about this this vote. You basically saying that it's going to destabilize things in the region, and that I mean, there was even a quote about you know, from an army colonel talking about it. Yeah, it's going to be undermining the fight against ISIS, but. You know, I tend to think the United States usually aligns itself with Israel in a lot of these issues, and it seems to me the United States might also benefit if you had another Kurdistan, especially one aligned with Israel, smack dab in this very oil-rich area. I mean, what do you think? Is the United States blowing a lot of steam, or do they really mean what they say?
It's not completely clear, though a lot of people in the Kurdish area believe that secretly the U.S. does support an independent Kurdistan, as you say. But publicly, they have their position has remained that they want a territorial integrity of Iraq, to Iraq to remain in a single country. You'll recall, after the invasion, Joe Biden and others talked about the breakup of Kurdistan, of Iraq into three Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish states. So there has been a position of some American officials, some high-ranking American officials. But right now, I think there might be some sincerity about the issue of ISIS, because if the Iraqi National Army, as I said, does divert troops to Kirkuk and other disputed areas with the Kurds, that would divert their war from ISIS. So ISIS would benefit from that. Now, ISIS has been defeated in Mosul, but there are pockets that still remain. They're not completely defeated. They could come back again. In fact, just yesterday there was a report that al-Baghdadi, the head of the Islamic State, is still alive, that there, a video of his was released in which he's talking about current issues. So ISIS is not a defeated force, and this referendum can divert attention from defeating them, and it was probably ill-timed in that way as well. Now, the State Department is the one who's said the strongest things against the referendum. They threatened to withdraw U.S. and U.N. support for negotiations with Baghdad and the Kurds. But a couple of days now after the referendum, the U.S. said they'll support those negotiations, not independence negotiations, but negotiations over these outstanding issues of oil and borders and the disputed areas. So that was a hollow threat by the United States. We haven't heard from the CIA or the Pentagon, don't really know what they have. There's some members of Congress who've come out in favor of an independent Kurdistan. So maybe at some point down the line, the U.S. would support this, but certainly not as ISIS is not defeated. And they're correct, and I don't often agree with the State Department, but I do hear that everyone should calm down, that meaning Turkey and Baghdad, and not take any rash actions, whether they're economic or military, against the Kurds, because this is a non-binding referendum that had no declaration of independence attached to it. It's not changing the status quo legally of the Kurdish region. There's no reason to take these aggressive moves against them, because I think this referendum will simply pass without any effect if nothing is done. So the U.S. is wise, I think, to call for calm right now, and I hope that they were able to have some influence over their allies in Ankara and in Baghdad.
Okay, I mean, just kind of just exploring the prospects of sovereignty for people in the Kurdistan region. I'm just looking at the level of Turkish business interest and investment in that region, and I'm wondering, even if you could get an independent Kurdistan, would it truly be self-governing, or would interference from Turkish and United States and other business interests turn it into more like a pre-Castro Cuba, again run by Turkish, Israeli, and U.S. business interests? Do you have any thoughts about that, this idea of a truly democratic, self-governing, an autonomous Kurdistan?
Well, it already is to a large extent run by outside business interests or influenced by it. Certainly there's a lot of American investment here, there's European investment here, there's Russian investment here. They're the largest investor in the Iraqi oil sector, as I said. So the economy would continue to depend on this foreign investment and trade with Turkey. That would not change. But how could an independent Kurdistan survive when there's only one country publicly supporting it? Even if the United States supported it, there's no chance it will become a UN member state. There's no chance it becoming, will go to the Olympics, or they will get IMF loans. The IMF has said they're only going to give loans through Baghdad. They won't give loans directly to Erbil. It'll have no international status whatsoever. Nothing will change in terms of how the economy is run. And how the political situation is here, which, is not wholly democratic either, I have to say. Barzani is going to have an election in November, by the way. So this referendum is certainly also intended to give him the support to finally be elected. Again, he's been holding office for 2 years after his term has ended. The parliament did not meet for 2 years until last week. when they approved this referendum. So there's no effective parliament in the country. There's a lot of corruption, as there is in most governments around the world, certainly in the Middle East. There's nepotism charges against him. His nephew is the prime minister. Will any of this change by becoming an independent country? No, the only thing that's going to change is they could be crushed economically now if Iraq and Turkey are stopped and they go ahead. So I don't see the point of this referendum other than to feel that they have defiantly told the world they are ready for independence, they want it, and that's all well and good. And many Kurds in Iraq, I was just communicating with someone in Erbil before I went on the air with you, and he said most people, they feel this was a victory. But it's a hollow victory because it doesn't change anything, and it only increases dangers to them.
One more question. I'm just reflecting on Ukraine and Yugoslavia and seeing how some of these ethnic and nationalistic passions can sometimes give way to tremendous political and economic upheaval and even bloodshed. What are the principal indicators that you will be watching for in relation to the Kurds in Iraq and other countries in the region in the weeks ahead?
Kirkuk in particular. That's where I think violence could start and could spread. If it could be avoided there, I think we will not see any bloodshed like we saw in Yugoslavia and in Ukraine. And I think how long an economic blockade, if it in fact is instituted, you know, Erdogan talks a big game a lot, and he never rarely follows up on it. So it's possible there is no economic blockade at all, that his, the business interests in Turkey are telling him not to do it. But if it does take place, how long will that remain in effect? Does it include oil? And what will that mean to the people of the Iraqi Kurdish region? Because without oil, within weeks, their economy will collapse, and there'll be really trouble there. And that could lead to bloodshed, too, I mean, out of desperation. So those are the two indicators, whether there's violence in Kirkuk and whether there really is an economic embargo and how long it may last.
Okay. Well, Joe Loria, I really appreciate your coming on. I know we've had a bit some communications clumsiness, but I want to thank you very much for making this interview work, and thank you so much for your time.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you for Michael, rather. Sorry, thank you for allowing me to speak on this issue.
We've been speaking with Joe Loria, veteran foreign affairs journalist and author of a recent article, "Vote by Iraqi Kurds Adds to Tensions." He joined us from Cairo. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.